Millions of people have come to rely on George Monbiot as a clear-headed investigator into the threats and possible solutions to climate change. Through his regular columns in Britain's respected Guardian newspaper, his books and appearances on television and radio, Monbiot has become more than a journalist. He's an activist and a player in the greatest drama unfolding in human history. This is Alex Smith of Radio Eco Shock, and I was galvanized by a speech George Monbiot gave to a packed house in Vancouver, November 15, 2006. He is someone you need to know. Monbiot has specialized in travels to uncharted territories. His exposé on rainforest destruction in Indonesia got him kicked out of the country. He chronicled the deep Amazon before the rest of us woke up to the global consequences there. Just recently, mass media is realizing that the tragedy of sub-Saharan Africa is fueled by our own carbon pollution. George Monbiot was there much earlier and nearly died from a disease contracted while covering events in East Africa. Back in the UK in the 1990s, Monbiot became a leader and focal point for a national struggle against endless road building throughout Britain. At one protest, a road builder pounded a metal spike into his foot. Now Monbiot is back for the greatest challenge of our time, how to save the ecosphere from human-made global warming. His latest book is called Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning. But it isn't all warnings and gloom. In fact, Monbiot has polled countless scientists and experts to develop a plan to save the planet from the worst scenarios, from mass extinctions and a collapsed economy. We'll try to pack in the best of Monbiot from several speeches and interviews, The Man and the Plan. One of his key points is the black irony of climate change. It is caused by industrialized nations in the temperate zone, yet the impacts are worst in the tropics, where less developed countries are least responsible. While Maasai tribes people have no water for their cattle, in North America and Europe, people may enjoy a little warming in the next few years, aside from the terrible storms, of course. Like a frog about to be boiled in a pot, at first we like the relaxing warm water. Typically, George begins with results from some of the latest science, one of his roles as climate communicator.
I'm afraid the news is really pretty grim, and it's not quite that the whole planet will turn into a desert. We are going to see a very severe drying of some of the world's productive areas. There was an article published in the Journal of Hydrometeorology last month, I'm sure you all read it, which investigated the big climate change question of whether across this century we're going to see a net global drying or a net global wetting as a result of increasing temperatures. And it's a hot question because as temperatures rise, the rate of evaporation rises, and that means that the ground dries out. But it also means with more evaporation, you get more rainfall. And scientists were uncertain as to what the balance of those two effects was likely to be. And this paper, using the latest information, the latest data, the latest computer models, shows pretty unequivocally that it's going to be a severe net drying. And the habitable area of the Earth subject to extreme drought rises from the current 3% to 40% by the end of the century.
The challenge, he tells us, is to prevent runaway climate change by keeping temperature rises below 2 degrees.
You find that in order to have a high chance, 70 to 80% chance, of preventing global temperatures from rising by 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, we require a global cut in greenhouse gas emissions of 60% by 2030. And if that global cut is to be distributed evenly, in other words, fairly, if, in other words, everybody is to have the same entitlement to produce carbon dioxide, that means in the rich nations, on average, a cut of 90%.
The problem for each of us personally is that climate change introduces a new morality. Things we learned long ago were good are now also bad, harmful to the Earth.
Pre-climate change morality is pretty straightforward. You treat people nicely. You look out for your neighbours. You say nice things to your friends. You don't do nasty things to anyone. It's fairly straightforward. You don't kill, you don't steal, etc., etc. We know what pre-climate change morality looks like. But post-climate change morality introduces a whole load of moral issues which are, or have been up to this point, alien to us. It requires an entirely new moral code. Those things which under the old morality were innocent or even good, under the new morality also turn out to be bad. Bringing the neighbours round to have a cup of tea, good and bad. Driving to school to pick up the kids, good and bad. Flying to Sydney to your brother's wedding, good and very bad. Very, very bad. I say this with some embarrassment as someone who's flown here to speak to you. In fact, when you look at that last example, when you look at the fact that what you are doing by flying to your brother's wedding in Sydney is redeeming what I call your love miles, the distance between yourself and the people you love, you see that the planet could be destroyed by love. That so many of those things which we see as irredeemably good are also under climate change intractably and irredeemably bad. And we see two valid moral codes here in irreconcilable antagonism.
He doesn't think carbon taxes are the way to go. The result there is the rich can afford to keep on wasting energy, while the poor may have to give up heating their houses or getting to work. Instead, he proposes a carbon rationing system, which reminds us of Britain in World War II. Perhaps this is the real war to save the world.
It's not my own idea, but it's the one which I think makes the most sense, and this is a carbon rationing system. In concept, it's very simple. The government says this is what our total emissions for this year should be, and every year they get lower. And then we divide that total into two blocks, one of 40% of the emissions, the other of 60%. The 40% corresponds to the energy that we use directly. When we are buying electricity and gas, when we pay our electricity and gas bills, when we buy gasoline to put in our cars, when we buy plane tickets and train tickets. The other 60%, that's the energy which is used on our behalf by corporations. And that 60% is auctioned off to those corporations by the government, which should do pretty well out of that auction. The 40%, which is that which we use directly, is divided by the number of people in the country, and we all get an equal share of it. And you get a carbon debit card, and every time you pay your natural gas bill or your electricity bill or fill up your tank with gasoline, you hand over your card and a little bit of your carbon ration gets taken off that card. If you run out before the end of the year, it's not the end of the world for you, but to carry on using energy, you must buy some surplus carbon ration from someone who's used less than their full ration. Because the rich tend to use more energy than the poor, this means that the rich will carry on doing that, but only having transferred a substantial portion of their wealth to the poor. And so we see an inbuilt progressivity in this system. But the other virtue of the system is that people can immediately see that it is fair. In December 1940, at the height of the Blitz in London, George Orwell wrote the following. The lady in the Rolls-Royce car does more to damage national morale than a fleet of Goering's bomber planes. And what he meant by that was that if you see that the system doesn't apply to everyone, that some people are cheating the system, then you're much less likely to want to participate in that system and believe that that system is going to work for you. But if you see that it applies to everyone, you're much happier staying within those limits. But there's a further advantage of a carbon rationing system, which is as follows. Obviously, people are going to want to keep the lights on. They're going to want to keep their heating on. They're going to want to keep travelling. And they're going to demand the lowest carbon means of doing those things. They're going to demand energy-efficient light bulbs so that they can keep the lights on while using the least possible portion of their carbon ration. They're going to demand low-carbon sources of electricity to power those lights. And you can see that the carbon rationing system starts to kick off the popular enthusiasm for a lot of the other proposals which I'm going to discuss.
I know that we can change.
Here are more Made in Monbiot solutions, a short selection from a much richer program in his book, How to Stop the Planet Burning.
If we start in the housing sector, we see a tremendous potential for energy efficiency. In Germany at the moment, there is a program to take 5% of the entire housing stock every year and to transform it into highly insulated, extremely energy efficient housing. So within 20 years, this government program will ensure that every home in Germany is extremely energy efficient and keeps the heat in. Also in Germany, you find that where new houses are built, there is a standard which is not yet universally applied, but could very well be, which is called the passive house, which requires no heating or cooling system. Now, the winter in Germany gets pretty harsh, pretty well like the Canadian winter. It gets down to about minus 30, minus 35 in the worst case. And yet these passive houses, as they call them, maintain throughout that harsh German winter a constant temperature of 19 degrees centigrade without any active heating system at all. And the trick is as follows. First of all, you build it in such a way that there are no thermal bridges. And what a thermal bridge is conducting material which runs from the inside of the house to the outside of the house, through which heat or cold can be conducted. So in other words, you have a complete thermal envelope around the house of insulation which prevents heat or cold from moving either way. You then ensure that wherever the house is ventilated, it's ventilated through a heat exchanger so that the warm air going out heats the cold air coming in. The cold air snatches the heat from the warm air as it comes in and you don't lose heat through that ventilation system. You then get the windows sized exactly to the size of the house and pointing at the right orientation so that the passive solar gain, the heating from the sun coming through the windows, is sufficient to provide most of the heat that the house requires. And extraordinarily, the rest, the final 2 degrees of that heat, comes from your own body heat. That's all that's required to bring it up to the right temperature.
And the appliances and gadgets in these houses must be terrifically stingy with carbon energy.
It is insane that in the 21st century we are still using this Victorian technology, the incandescent light bulb. It's incomprehensible. It doesn't do anyone any good. It costs us a fortune to use incandescent light bulbs. And yet, still, you go into a shop and it's almost impossible to buy the compact fluorescents or the LEDs that you want in the particular models that you're going for, even though they use just one-tenth or so of the energy which your incandescent light bulb uses. There are fridges and freezers now which have what are called vacuum-insulated panels around them. They save about 80% of the energy of a standard fridge or freezer. But in most places, it's almost impossible to get hold of them because nobody even knows that they exist. And it goes on and on. The potential for energy efficiency with appliances is absolutely enormous, but it will only be realized if government starts to put pressure on the manufacturers and to say every year the energy efficiency standard has got to rise by X percent, and you just put this constant upward pressure on them. They're perfectly capable of doing it, but they've just got no incentive at the moment to do so.
Monbiot's preferred energy solution is renewables. Here he describes offshore wind with a new delivery system that takes this power far inland.
But you're not going to get all the way by that means, and you have to decarbonize the energy supply as well. And there are several favored methods. I'll just talk about one of them briefly, which is to go to where the ambient energy is most reliable and in greatest supply. And that, in my mind, is offshore. With every 100 kilometers from the coast, wind speeds rise on average by 1 meter per second. The further out you are, the stronger the wind is and the more consistent it is. And my plan is to do the opposite to what many environmentalists are calling for. A lot of environmentalists are very keen on decentralized microgeneration with little wind turbines on top of your house. Generally, people build their houses where it's less windy rather than more windy. And that's not where the really powerful sources of ambient energy are. But to go offshore a long way out, past the migration routes of the birds, past any area which you can see from the land so that there's no visual intrusion and the only people whose aesthetic sensibilities are challenged are trawlermen, right out, as far out on the continental shelf as you can build before the water gets too deep to put your pilings down. And to start experimenting with 10 megawatt wind turbines, huge great beasts, hundreds of metres across, I mean, really going up to a massive scale which hasn't been contemplated before, but is already technologically feasible. And then to feed in the electricity from those distant sources with high voltage direct current cables. And this is one of the missing ingredients which we haven't considered sufficiently up till now, that the means of transmission are almost as important as the means of generation. And one of the problems with these distant sources of high ambient energy is that they are very distant. And if you use the standard means of transmission that we use on the grid, which is alternating current, it's very expensive and you lose a lot of electricity along the way. With the new direct current cable technologies, you lose very little electricity and they have a maximum economic length of 4,500 kilometres. This means we can start using a range of renewable energy areas which we'd never contemplated before. And it means you start getting something which is really the holy grail of renewable energy, which is reliability. Because if you go out to where the wind is, and if you start making use of a much wider set of regions than you've used in the past, the likelihood is that at any one time the wind is blowing, or your other sources of energy, be they tidal or wave or indeed solar, are likely to be available in at least one of the regions that you're tapping into. By these means and several others, which I won't have time to go into, the energy and heating supply can be decarbonised by 90% by 2030 without a great deal of trouble, using technologies which already exist. What do we do with this hole in the sky and the pollution in the air? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? You and I.
Then, to support the inevitable continuation of the private car, Monbiot proposes to make them all electric. There is no problem with performance in existing electric car technology. The challenge is to keep them going long distances without waiting for a recharge. His answer? Replace gasoline filling stations with battery replacement depots. You drive in, a little crane comes out, takes out your old battery, drops in a new fully charged one. You don't buy the battery, but lease it. These batteries can be recharged by energy companies at night when power demand is low, but supply from sources like offshore wind continues to be strong. Sadly, Monbiot finds there is no existing solution to decarbonize air travel. The only way to get a 90% cut in airplane emissions is to fly 90% less. Localize your economy and choose lovers and families within low-carbon land travel range. This always draws a gasp from the middle-class audiences who love to travel, especially to get away in winter for holidays. Is it too great a sacrifice?
This might seem grotesque and unfair and onerous, but I would remind you that only a very, very small proportion of the world's people fly. The great majority of people on Earth, including almost all those who are going to get hit hardest by climate change, have never and will never step onto an aeroplane. And if this seems particularly unfair, it's because that tiny minority who fly almost certainly includes all of you. But put this into perspective. The last great global crisis, which is in any way comparable to the one that we face with climate change, was the Second World War. And the Allied powers saw very clearly that if they did not stand up and fight against this great threat to a democratic or vaguely or nominally democratic world order, that a catastrophe would ensue. And that was a reasonable prediction. And so they had to turn to their people and say, we have to stop Hitler, and we have to stop the Japanese, we have to stop the Axis powers. And we are asking you, millions of you, to sacrifice your lives in order to stop those people and in order to stop this global catastrophe from unfolding. Now, I'm saying, alongside many other people, we have to stop runaway climate change, a catastrophe just as great, possibly even greater, than Hitler promised. A catastrophe which has the potential to kill hundreds of millions of people. And I'm not asking you to sacrifice your lives. I'm asking you to sacrifice your holidays in Florida. I'm asking you to sacrifice your monster SUVs, which you might drive. I'm asking you to sacrifice a little bit of the energy that you use for lighting and heating by going to more efficient models. If we can't bear the thought of that sacrifice, we have become a very soft and selfish people. It's not a big deal. By comparison to what we're up against, by comparison to what climate change threatens, it is not a big sacrifice to ask of people. And it seems onerous because we are in those temperate nations which, in the early years at least, do pretty well out of climate change. It looks good, it feels good. We don't feel the urgent necessity of doing something about it, but let me tell you, in Ethiopia they do right now, because in Ethiopia, every year, the short rains are failing, and they are failing because of rising sea surface temperatures in the Indian Ocean, and those rising sea surface temperatures are the direct result of what we are doing in countries like this. And already, we are having that impact on them. And if this country was at the latitude of Ethiopia, and if my country was at the latitude of Ethiopia, we would have cracked this problem by now. And we would have seen those sacrifices as being very, very minor sacrifices indeed.
And this is where Monbiot ends and your part begins.
Now, what I've done in this talk is very briefly and in very little detail to sketch out some of the technological and economic means by which a 90% cut in carbon emissions by 2030 could be achieved. What I've not done is to demonstrate that it is politically feasible. And there's a reason for this. It's quite deliberate that I have not done this. The reason that I have not set out to demonstrate that it is politically feasible is that it is not up to me to do so. It's up to you.
Find out more about George Monbiot at www.monbiot.com. That's MONBIOT.com. And get his whole program in the new book, Heat, How to Stop the Planet Burning, from Penguin Press. Music in this podcast is by Shane Phillip. This report is from Radio EcoShock, the net's only full-time all-environment radio station. Tune in free and subscribe to our podcast at www.ecoshock.org. www.ecoshocklikeanelectricshock.org.
This is for all the protesters who are standing up along the line, standing up for what you believe, and it doesn't matter what the price. This is for all the peace lovers who are peacing out on this great land, peacefully being passive while the aggressors are getting out of hand. Thank you for your passion and conviction. I just wanna thank you for you. You're never gonna give it up.